Well, it's not uncommon for serious wounding to result in a personality devoted to healing, to giving healing. One of the cliches of psychiatrists, I won't comment on, do they need it more than their patients, you know? But there is a common perception of artists as very messed up people. That does not take into account the vast percentage of the population who are very messed up and who are not artists.
But it is a process of reaching out and finding a connection with other people through whatever you have to give, just having an effect on other human beings. We all want that, I think. This is Carolyn Gage.
I met Carolyn Gage online. It was a theater discussion list, and her posts on theater from the perspective of a radical lesbian feminist playwright managed to raise hackles with some people. I tend to run away from ideological discussions, but I am interested in how people with very passionate beliefs, how did they evolve? What was that journey? So a few years later, we met at a conference and had a great discussion. Recently, we talked by phone, and thanks to Madeline, an audio engineer in Maine, for recording and providing a few laughs in the background. This is Carolyn Gage.
I have an unusual life history in some ways, and then a sadly usual one. I was raised with a lot of abuse. There was sexual abuse, emotional, verbal, and, you know, just cruelty, sadism. And so what I did was I had this, I had this movie going on, which was the upper middle class, normal, high achieving child with a privileged background. And then what was actually going on was, you know, I was terrified all the time and practicing a very, very high level of dissociative disorder. I would enter the world of the dollhouse, and I would play really intensely in an altered state for up to 6 to 8 hours at a stretch in the dollhouse with these kinds of mini-series. I had 50 dolls, and they all had elaborate psychological and genealogical backgrounds and very complicated relationships with each other. And, you know, it was a whole world, and this is where I invested reality. This was much more real to me. It's kind of like, I think of it like in the early Japanese Godzilla horror films, the way that the people are kind of running, you know, in the foreground, and then these monsters are in the background, and they're kind of fake. And that's what the adults were like, these large blundering monsters that were very unbelievable. And as with most trauma survivors, the thing that kept you going as a child will ruin your adult life if you don't get an intervention. So there was years of hitchhiking around the country and engaging in extremely high-risk behavior, which we now know is post-traumatic, but I didn't know that. And then I became a chiropractic student and was kind of crunchy granola natural healer path. And then I was a Christian Science housewife. And then from there, I became a kind of radical lesbian playwright. And that one stuck. I thought it was another movie, and it was sort of time to move on. And I realized, oh, you know what? This is really who I am. I used to love this Ben Affleck movie where he was describing his life as an alcoholic, saying, well, you know, it's like I'm driving this car and I keep looking in the rearview mirror and I see all these bloody people in wrecked cars and I don't know what that's about. It's like that's sort of the wake of a trauma survivor. Like, who are all those angry people in my past that won't speak to me anymore? Let's see. The hitchhiking, well, what terminated that? I think it was someone believed in me, and he was in love with me to his great misfortune because I was really not available, but I thought I was. But mostly what I got from that was that somebody actually believed I was a quality person worth investing in, and that inspired me, and I realized that I could not partner him unless I had something that was my own also. So for me, that sent me back to school, and being back at school made me center a little bit. I was very serious about healing, and I can remember a particular point in time where we all had our own cadavers, you know, and we were dissecting them. And I remember I had this Native American kind of wasted alcoholic, probably a street person body, because that's how we got them. And We were removing the eyeball, and I remember I had taken the eye out, and I was holding it up and looking at it, and there was just this kind of voice that said, "There's no vision in this eye, and there never was." And I didn't know what to make of that, because it's sort of like, well, it once saw, now it's dead, it doesn't see anymore. But it was crystal clear to me that this is a thing. It never had powers of perception in the first place. And I started talking about this kind of aggressively with people, like, really, what is life? And I remember in one of my labs, somebody laughed and said, "Hey, you sound like a Christian Scientist." And I was like, "I mean, Christian, forget it." You know, I was like, "What is that?" And some of the people, two of them actually, their parents had been Christian Scientists, and they were just like devil over. They were like, "Oh my God." And I said, "Well, is there some kind of book?" And that just sent them into gales of laughter. They're like, "Oh, is there a book?" And of course, later I realized the whole religion is this one book, Science and Health. So I went and I got the book, and I read it, and it really rocked my world. It really rocked my world. You have to understand, I was Quaker and, you know, anti-war and all that, but I wasn't at all Christian. But what she was talking about was really familiar to me. It was paradigm shifting. And if you could shift into the right paradigm, not only were you somebody who didn't have the broken arm, but you never had it. So the healing would be instantaneous because, you know, you're not healing from it. It was like waking up with a case of antlers. You don't need them surgically removed. You need to come to an understanding. It's completely impossible for you to have them in the first place. You know, that is not like positive thinking. I got it because I've been doing that all my life. So I started going to the Christian Science Church, and this is really hard to do. Everybody was, you know, some totally conservative Republicans. All of the church was almost entirely women over the age of 60 who wore flowered hats and gloves to church. And I'm like, okay, you know, sometimes the search for truth takes you into some damn strange places. And I'm sitting in this church, you know, and I saw healings that just blew me away. They were amazing, and they were instant, and they were not possible. So that was pretty persuasive, and I ended up leaving chiropractic school, and I became a Christian Science practitioner, and I did that for a number of years. Yeah, that was a marvelous discipline, and the moral fiber of these people. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's some that are just defy description, you know, like people that had a growth on their face forever, huge, probably cancerous, and it's gone, like just gone, like gone, didn't shrink, didn't, you know, recede, just not there. Yeah, they're like not, it's just really hard to describe. But I want to also say my experience as a Christian Science practitioner, I saw it used to enable domestic violence. I saw some practices with children that are borderline neglect. You know, I mean, I suppose any system of belief, you can rope it into whatever, you know. I would say, there were a lot of healings, but one of them that stands out in my mind because it was illustrative of how it works was, she wasn't even coming to me as a client. I was in a restaurant, and there was a woman I knew from one of my former, I think from my chiropractic days, who was waitressing. And she was talking to me about smoking and what a struggle she was having with that. And I was kind of going into that Christian Science place, the paradigm shift, which is the place from which you heal. And I looked at her from that place, and I said, "But you've never smoked." And she looked at me like with shock. She literally jumped and she said, "That's right." And that was the end of that. And I ran into her a couple of years later at a party, and she came up to me and said, "You know, we had a conversation in a restaurant once and I never picked up another cigarette again in my life." I left because I was lesbian and the church had a hideously homophobic policies at that time. And I was really needing to, the Christian Science years were very focused on metaphysics and to the total exclusion of living in a political vacuum. And then suddenly it was time for me to go pick up that piece, and I couldn't reconcile it with my spiritual practice. But as with a lot of people who are involved in systems like that, as soon as I left the church, I became completely disabled. And I was disabled for about 10 years. I had chronic fatigue syndrome. Really severe. And, you know, I had all the huge multiple chemical sensitivity I had a lot of psychiatric disability from the B vitamin deficiency that I hadn't identified, and brain lesions, encephalitis, and just, it was a crazy, it was almost like everything went haywire. So it was, you know, somebody cut off my escape routes. A lot of survivors, when the memories catch up and stuff, or when your systems break down and you can't do what you used to do to cope, it's just, it really crashes the system. It was really scary. I really came so close to not making it. I'm driving around the piece of hose for 3 years, like thinking, okay, you know, one more turn of the screw and I'm out of here. And that's like no way to, I mean, that's my biggest self-soothing thing, was the piece of hose. That's kind of, as we say in Maine, that's living small. So then I consciously began to rebuild my spirituality with the tools of Dianic Wicca. And after having practiced Christian Science, like your life depended on it, Wicca really felt like the sandbox to me for a while. You know, the deep metaphysics, people who are literally dying of some hideous disease and refusing painkillers and using metaphysics. I mean, I saw, just in terms of character, the character of some of these old women doing the Christian Science, I feel like they were sort of the witches. So Wicca was very, very, you know, felt like a huge step down. Candles and chanting and, you know, but if these people got cancer, you know, they're not going to sit and light candles. And the Christian Scientist closes the door, gets their books out, and works. Well, when you think of the brain as a system of synapses, it's like I severed every synapse that I had, every system of support or any organizing system for data or sense of identity. I ripped out overnight, and the chaos psychically was really staggering. I mean, I often felt if people held a voltmeter over me, like that there would be electrical storms. You know, it was just really, really dangerous what I did. Yeah, it was like radical feminism held me together, barely. But that was it. Yeah, it was pretty, it was rough. It was really rough. Hey, well, actually, you know, I think that the way I put that desire to heal is in my plays. You're spell casting at a really profound level. Powerful spells, and that's me back at the dollhouse. That's a safe place for me to put it now that I've integrated. I'm clear. This is a fantasy. This is a play. But I have total control of that world, and I don't have to be controlling of people in my environment anymore to that extent. You know, I think what I work with is I work with censored archetypes. One of them is the survivor who thrives, who recruits others, who is believed, and who avenges herself. The avenging mother, the fiercely protective avenging mother who sides with her daughter against the husband. That's a pretty censored archetype. The older woman who liberates herself and begins a second life that is far more joyous and free. I mean, it's like thinking you're an ugly duckling your whole life, and then suddenly, like, you find the swans. It's like, oh, I am so gorgeous. I was doing the Second Coming of Joan of Arc up in Minneapolis, or Minnesota, St. Cloud, I think, and I was talking to the students because that piece is like, you know, 90 minutes of rage. And afterwards, I said, you know, like, we are oppressed as women, and oppressed people are angry. And you're no different than Joan of Arc. You just somewhere different. I said, you know, angry women cut, they binge, they purge, they drink, they're promiscuous, you know, they're depressed. And that's turning it against yourself. So after the performance, this woman comes up to me, and she's really mousy, like just really like so like the potty posture. And she's physically petite and, you know, excuse me for living type of, you know, countenance. And she's like, you know, excuse me, can I talk to you? And I said, yeah, what? And she said, I'm the angriest woman you've ever met. And I started laughing because she was like, so the opposite of that. And I said, oh, really? And she said, yes, I do every single thing that you said. And then she burst into tears. And, of course, it was great. I was able to kind of steer her to the women's studies and women's resource people and, like, you know, get an intervention going for her. But that was a rewarding moment because she had probably never said that to anybody because those are shameful things, you know, to vomit after dinner and to cut yourself. These are, you just think you're whacked. It's like, this is your guilty secret. And those are moments, you know, like people come up to me after a show and it's not, oh, that was great. Or where do you do your research? They just come up with urgency and they say, my uncle raped me when I was 12 and I never told anybody. And that's when I know I did a good show. And I have one time there's a woman in a performance and she started laughing hysterically at the rape when I got up to the rape scene. Joan of Arc was raped as part of her trying to break her spirit thing. And my first thought was, oh, there's a heckler in the house. And, you know, so I'm kind of running the play and at the same time thinking, there's a house manager. Do I leave the stage? Blah, blah, blah. And you could feel the whole audience freeze. And then it was like, you could feel the whole house thinking that with me, like, uh-oh. And then spontaneously, we all got, it's a survivor having trouble. You could feel that whole shift, the first shift and the second shift. And after that second shift, when we realized there's a woman in trouble in the audience, it was a women-only house. And there was this, I almost felt like we knit together. It's like we locked arms around her protectively. It was just so real. I mean, it's the war was really in the room with us.
Well, I'm always envious of people who seem to have found their tribe, their identity, their home. So I asked, was the lesbian separatist community a real utopia for you?
Oh, Madeline's laughing. I don't know why. You know, why is she laughing at that? It was all perfect sisterhood, and don't we all just love each other? And wasn't it just like you thought it would be? Yeah. No, that was another fantasy that, you know, well, now the men are all gone, so it's all going to be, everybody's going to be a mommy to me or a sister. And you know, that was, well, you know, actually what I learned is about decolonization. And as with many people who decolonize, the first thing that happens when you get among your own people in a separatist state is you really see the damage because we begin to enact it on each other. So I experienced a tremendous amount of emotional violence in the separatist communities, but it was always, to me, whatever lesbians were doing, and that's still true, is enormously significant culturally. And it's just like that first generation out of Egypt. They're not fit for the promised land. They've got slave habits, slave paradigms. So you wander around the wilderness for a while. And I remember Women's Land. We would have like a six-hour collective meeting to discuss whether or not male dogs should be allowed on the land. And people laugh at that now. And it's easy to laugh at a bunch of land dykes sitting around the table and passionately discussing that. But when you really get down to what that discussion was about, and male dogs are different. We were really, really deconstructing gender, and we were really desperately, like our life depended on it, trying to decolonize and invent a different world and try to understand the source of our oppression. So a lot of it seemed wildly dysfunctional like that, and yet at the same time, like what more significant inquiry, you know, when we're 2 minutes on the doomsday clock than the nature of maleness and, you know, that sort of thing. So easy to laugh at, like Christian Science, but, you know, like those of us who are just really paying attention, you know, the truth is often, the search for truth will often take you to places that are embarrassing. The true seekers of truth, like, live with embarrassment all the time, and I guess I've come to embrace mortification. I'm thinking, you know, this is going to go out on the airwaves. You know, that seems very unreal sitting here talking to you and Madeline. I'm like, this is going to be very public. I'm in Maine. I'm in Maine where the slogan is, it's life the way it should be. Exactly. And that's probably why I'm here. I'm here, it's a writer's state, and I like that. And I like four seasons because I know that things are changing. But I'm writing, I'm touring still, but it's been a very fruitful time for me in terms of writing. For fun, I like to go to Acadia, Mount Desert Island. I love that place, it's magical, and I also like to embroider banners for my friends with sayings on them that are meaningful to them. And fun, what do I do for fun? I walk a lot. You know, I just always have done that. I love to walk places. Yeah, and Maine is gorgeous for walk-in places. My spirituality is really embracing reality. Reality is my spiritual path these days, and it's the hardest walk I've ever walked. Yeah, I feel like it's pretty real. Pretty real. The Wicca I use kind of as a symbolic system, but I think the thing that's the practice I'm using is pretty, it's pretty based on reality, embracing reality.
From Portland, Maine, we were talking with Carolyn Gage. Carolyn's website has information about her plays and performances. It's www.carolyngage.com.
I'd like to remind you that you can listen to all of our shows anytime for free on our website. That's www.hitching.org. You can purchase CDs, anthologies, audio dramas. If you have friends who are slightly strange or who could be with a little effort, give a gift.
The ultimate wounding and healing story is The Descent of the Goddess Inanna, an ancient Sumerian myth that we adapted to audio drama. We have a CD version. It's had extraordinary response. And if you have interest in coming back from bad places, Descent of the Goddess Inanna is for you.
Our next story, Ludwig van Tricht.
I'm originally from Southwest Philly. From a working class neighborhood called Pascal, which when I grew up was predominantly an African American community. I kind of come from a distinct period of time having grown up in the 60s. I guess what's kind of unique, I think, about my family, my background, is schizophrenia has kind of run throughout my family's history.
Back in Philadelphia, we produced a series called Weavers, about people who crossed boundaries from one world to another. This is one of our favorites, Finding the Music with Ludwig van Tricht.
My mother was schizophrenic. My mother's sister, my mother's brother, my mother's father, and I also have a brother and sister who are schizophrenic. So I kind of grew up with an element of madness in my personal life. And I think during the times that I grew up, I think there was an element of madness in those times. But I never really had an awareness of the family's madness until one of my uncles came to live with us. He was kept in a boarding home. And the woman who controlled the boarding home was taking his money. And he was eating out of garbage cans and whatnot. And so we took him in. So he came to live with us. And roughly around that time also, my sister had what laymen call a nervous breakdown. That involved having somebody who I loved very deeply as a child, seeing this person who had always been very bright and friendly and just full of life descend into somebody who would lay in bed screaming all day long, and who strangely enough developed a fixation on Johnny Mathis. My sister had this theory that the Johnny Mathis that you see on album covers was not the real Johnny Mathis. So I guess in some way, I guess that's a deep metaphor, having a fixation on Johnny Mathis. I'm not sure how I was able to kind of survive all that, because there were times when I was a child where it was like being in an insane asylum, in that I would have one uncle prancing about and saying all kinds of various things that were rooted in biblical prophecies, and my brother would talk to himself, and he would have this obsessive behavior where he would constantly comb his hair and prance back and forth, and then my sister would lay in bed and scream all day. And my mother often was out drinking. But I think at an early age as a child, I learned to kind of cut myself off from much of what was happening around me. And then the other thing that I developed, which for a child was very different, was I developed a love for jazz. And I remember very vividly hearing Sonny Rollins for the first time as a kid and just being drawn to this music. And I can remember the first time hearing Archie Shepp and how it kind of just sent chills down my back, down my spine. I found the music, as it's often called. I always hear people refer to it as the music. I kind of found the music early on, and that was an escape for me. Well, I would say that in the wee small hours of the morning, before everyone in my household awoke, I would try to find different little rituals that I would do before the day broke. And my uncle just was not able to really live in a house, going to the bathroom without it involving urinating all over or defecating all over, or when he ate, we had to put paper down. So earlier on, I developed a habit that whenever I heard him get up to go to the bathroom, I would already have a bucket of disinfectant and a mop. So as my mother didn't have to deal with that. I would try to, before the household woke up, just go downstairs and listen to music. And just have a little space of my own. We had a Blue Punk stereo in our living room, and that was where I first heard Sonny Rollins' Freedom Suite. And I just remember the rhythms of Max Roach on drums and Oscar Pettiford on bass and Nuke, as they call him, on tenor saxophone. And the music back then seemed to mirror the times more. You know, there were composers who were wrestling with deep social issues, and there was that stoic picture of John Coltrane where he has this real mean face on A Love Supreme, and he's dealing with searching for himself and trying to be a better person. And on some level, as a kid, that's what I was attempting to do. So I would wake up with candles and burn candles and have incense and listen to Coltrane and things. And then I put on a lot of political trappings as an adolescent. I tried to read Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth and tried to become the blackest person a black person could be back then to kind of compensate for being so light-skinned. And I tried to have some political consciousness about myself, even though I didn't, in political terms, know how to deal with my family and what was going on there. I just didn't quite understand what was happening in my house. Black people are just such a strange people, and even within my own family, which was very dysfunctional, there are times of warmth and of laughter and of humor. To me, there's a certain cadence and rhythm to being a black person, to being an African American, that is just different from other people. Particularly, I say the element of humor, the way we look at things. It's those times that I've felt some affinity for being who I was. The real culture that was a culture for me was a very literate and very sophisticated culture of jazz and of the black arts movement, of those things that one could tie into beauty, things that one could tie into hope. Yeah, it still was a family. It still was a family, a very complicated family. I mean, my mother always said to me that the reason she allowed my uncle to still stay with us was because she remembered how good her brother was to her when she was growing up, before he became ill. Well, this is gonna sound very twisted, but my uncle and I, as I got older, used to often fight. You know, when you're young and you don't understand mental illness, you don't know where this abhorrent behavior from a person comes from. One time, I had just started a fight with my uncle, and we got into a fist fight, and I knocked him down very hard. And my mother was so upset over what happened, because she thought I had killed him because he didn't move, that she started going into what seemed to be a heart attack. So here she was upstairs in the hallway having what I thought was a heart attack, and here my uncle is, I think, dead that I've killed him. And she's upset because she thinks I'm going to go to jail because I've killed my uncle. And to me, that was family because it showed how much she cared for me.
From Philadelphia, you were listening to Ludwig van Tricht. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. Next month, more stories. We just haven't decided yet which ones.
We have a 90-year-old folk singer, a State Department interpreter who decided he did not want to interpret lies, a woman in the wilds of Alaska, that good old American institution, the car crash, lots of stuff coming up.
And if you're in the North Bay, on the final Friday of each month, we produce a live event in Sebastopol, the Hitchhiker's Cabaret Cauldron. It's an extraordinary performance circle, and there's free popcorn, and it helps support this show. Email us through the website for information, www.hitching.org. This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
We could just put out one newspaper, the boys are at it again, and that's it, and just take it every day and read it and put a new date on it. It's the same news. And then the second page would be, you know, what are we doing about it? You know, and that's, yeah, that's the news.